One of the best parts of interview segments is learning more about the people I talk to. I'm Karen Carmichael. Today I am thrilled to welcome someone who's dedicated to community service in St. Petersburg. For anyone who hasn't already met her, today you will meet Council Vice Chair Lizette Hanowitz, an accomplished attorney, community leader, and passionate advocate for the people of our city. Lizette is the daughter of Cuban exiles who came to the United States during the Freedom Flights. Lizette's career spans roles as a former assistant state attorney in Pinellas County and an assistant U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Florida, where she honed her legal expertise. She earned her law degree from the University of Florida's Levin College of Law, and she also has an MBA from Florida International University. But Lizette's contributions extend far beyond the courtroom. She's been an instrumental figure in the Crescent Lake Neighborhood Association, where she served as president from 2016 to 2021 and has led numerous initiatives to improve the community. From mentoring local students through the Pinellas County Schools Lunch Pals program to serving as chair of the Shirley Proctor Pulla Foundation, her dedication to public service is truly inspiring. She also holds key roles in several committees and boards, including the Budget, Finance, and Taxation Committee, the Arts Advisory Committee, the Social Services Allocation Committee, and she is chair of the Public Services and Infrastructure Committee, just to name a few. On top of all her professional accomplishments, Lizette is a Florida native who calls St. Petersburg home. She and her husband, Wayne, have two daughters and are raising their youngest here, alongside their dog, Ginger, and two cats, Saint and Pete. Her roots run deep in the community, and she's committed to making St. Petersburg a place where all families can thrive. Join me today as we hear from Council Vice Chair Lizette Hanowitz about her journey, her vision for the future of St. Petersburg, and how she's working to make a difference in the lives of our residents. Lizette, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Karen. Thank you for having me here.
It's so good to see you. So I have learned so much about you doing a little bit of research into you. I mean, I've known you for a while, but there are so many layers to Lizette Hanowitz.
Well, it's funny because I still remember, I think, the time where we got together for lunch the first time around when we were working in the neighborhood associations, right?
Yeah.
And with Kona. And that's how we got to know each other. And
exactly.
Here we are. You're on Radio St. Pete, and I'm on City Council. Who would have predicted that?
Exactly. I know. From the Sunshine Center, right?
That's exactly.
Here we are today.
That's exactly right.
So one thing I didn't know about you was that you worked as a U.S. attorney for the Middle District of Florida. What was that experience like?
It's funny because before I was a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor, I was a state prosecutor here in Pinellas County. So it was an extension of what I was doing as a prosecutor. I was just doing it at the federal level. It was a very interesting experience. Obviously, it was an honor to work as a U.S. assistant attorney. It's interesting because at the state level, you think it's political, but then you get into the federal level and it's pretty political system. But I really enjoyed my time working in the federal government and learning how to prosecute federal cases. I tried a few cases in federal court and that was extremely interesting. And yeah, it was definitely a wonderful time that I spent there at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Do you have one case that particularly sticks out to you?
Oh, boy. There's lots of cases both at the state level and the federal level. At the federal level, I remember I tried this case where it was in Pasco County. And it was, you know, you have some people that kind of consider themselves sovereign citizens and they don't feel like they should be beholden to the laws of the United States or any state. And this case involved an individual like that who had basically threatened federal officials or even the postman from coming to the house and had lots of firearms. And to protect anyone who would come to the house, we prosecuted him under, he was a felon, and so he should not have those firearms. And it was a really interesting case because of that sovereign citizen angle. And I will tell you, the FBI had to investigate his family because there were threats that were made online.
Wow.
That dealt with me. And that was something that was new for me.
And scary.
And scary. Oh, absolutely. Especially you're just doing your job. These cases were never personal. Mm-hmm. My role, obviously, was to do the right thing as a prosecutor and protect the citizens of the United States or the state of Florida. And that's what I would do. And if I couldn't prove a case, then it wasn't going to be brought forward. We had a standard in terms of bringing charges against an individual, and you had to have a good faith basis that you could prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt in court. Otherwise, you wouldn't bring a case. So to have someone threaten you because you're doing your job, that is unnerving. But it worked out fine. We got the conviction, and it was quite interesting case. And then at the state level, I would say I had a few big cases. There was one case that I had that was on national TV, and I found out it was going to be on national TV.
Oh my gosh.
Right before the trial, which is pretty unnerving knowing that it's going to be filmed live, and it was on court TV. And the case involved teenagers who were arguing over a boy, two girls, and one girl stabbed the other girl fight, which is incredibly tragic.
Yeah.
And in that case, it was on court TV, and so that was completely unexpected. And I guess because it involved a love triangle and teenagers and just the facts and circumstances surrounding it made it an interesting case. It was quite the challenge prosecuting a case like that when it's in the newspapers, because when you're picking out a jury, and the Tampa Bay Times, the head story that Sunday before we picked out a jury on Monday, it was front page, the case itself. And so that makes it challenging. But it was a very interesting case. There were stand your ground issues. That was at the beginning where the stand your ground law had come into play. So you have to have a mini trial even before you have the trial. And that makes it interesting in terms of prosecuting a case, and of course, dealing with teenagers, they always make interesting witnesses. You just have no idea what's going to happen. And it got a little bit crazy.
I'm sure
at times it got a little bit crazy. So I was very fortunate. I had a really big case that was on national TV, and then you get interviewed by Dateline in 2020. And every once in a while, I think the show Snapped comes on, and it came out on Snapped. One of my assistants contacted me and told me that they were contacting me regarding the case. And she was like, you have to do it. It's Snapped. You have to do this show. So it's still out there, some of these episodes on the case. So yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So as the daughter of Cuban exiles, right, who came to the United States with the Freedom Flights, are you the first college graduate in your family?
I am. My family came in the late 60s, 68. My family could not leave Cuba. As a matter of fact, my grandfather was killed by the communist regime.
Wow.
My mom described the environment in Cuba as you would find in, like, Animal Farm. If you read the book, George Orwell, Animal Farm, that's how she described her conditions over there. And obviously, there's no free speech. You cannot speak against the government. My grandfather did not agree with the policies of the Castro regime, and because of that, he paid the ultimate price. One day, my grandmother's at home. They came and knocked on the door. They took him, and 2 days later, my grandmother gets a call that my grandfather had committed suicide.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Wow. And as tragic as that is, he wasn't the only person that happened to it. I mean, it's sad to say. That was just something that would occur.
It was the norm.
And wow, People don't realize that. And my grandfather was killed. And afterwards, when they had the opportunity to come to the U.S. through the Freedom Flights, I still remember my mom telling me the story. Imagine being in a country like Cuba and knowing all the things that are happening. And they tell you, well, if you want to leave, you can get on these planes. And you're just not sure what's true, what's not true.
Oh, sure.
And they were able to come to the United States through the Freedom Flights, which
So for people that don't know what that is.
So there were flights that were actually coordinated between the U.S. government and Cuba, and it brought hundreds of thousands of Cubans here into the U.S., and they actually ended up in different places. My mom and my father ended up in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, from the Freedom Flight, and then eventually made their way to Tampa, which is where I was born in Tampa, Florida, at Tampa General Hospital. And so it was a policy back then. They stopped it. I can't remember. It may have lasted late 60s to maybe 71, somewhere around there, and the policy stopped. But that allowed Cubans that weren't in agreement with the island to leave the Castro regime. And interestingly enough, people don't realize it was pretty smart of that regime to do that, because all you do is you get people that disagree with you to leave. And it's much easier to control the people that agree with you and get rid of all the people that don't agree with you. And he did that at various stages. You didn't just have it in the Freedom Flights. The Mariel boat lift happened where a lot of Cubans left. And then what they did is they emptied out kind of the prisons, right? And mental institutions, and let people out. And it sent them to, the U.S., which is horrible, because there were a lot of good people that came through that. But then you had all the bad press of some of the criminals that were actually on purpose released by the Castro regime.
Wow.
And I think that may have been some of the stuff that's also happening in Venezuela now with some of the people that are being released by the government to different countries. I was just in Peru and they were having issues similar to that. So so my family came, and I was born in Tampa, Florida.
Wow.
And my mom and my grandmother raised me. After my mom and my dad got divorced, I was 2 years old. My mom ended up in Miami, and that's where I was raised, and with my mom and my grandmother. And I left Miami. The first time I left Miami was to go to law school at University of Florida. And life somehow brought me back to the Tampa Bay area. I would have never imagined being here, because I don't have family here. And it was because of my husband that I ended up in the Tampa Bay area back in after law school. I finished law school in 2004, took the bar exam, and so.
What made you choose law?
Funny, since I was young, I wanted to be a lawyer. And then I worked with lawyers, and I thought I didn't want to be a lawyer. Which is not surprising sometimes when you do the work and you think, is this really the type of work I want to do? But I work with lawyers. I had to drop out of school to start working full-time and help my mom. Mm-hmm. So I went, got my high school diploma at night. I worked during the day. I went to school at night. I even had a job in the weekend. Yeah, it was a lot of work. And then so it took me a while to get my bachelor's. But in the meantime, I worked with attorneys. I worked at sole practitioner's office, bigger law firms. And I changed my mind on my degree, like most young people. What am I going to do? And I got my bachelor's in psychology. Then I got an MBA. But I still had that yearning. And I remember going through the MBA program.
So the MBA came first?
The MBA came first.
Wow.
Yes. And it was during the MBA that I made the decision that I am going to go to law school, because I did not want to regret not getting my law degree. And it was hard for me because in Miami at the time, there was only a private university, which was University of Miami. Florida International University did not have a law program. And I was paying all this by myself. So my only options really in terms of going to a state program was University of Florida and Florida State University. So I knew that if I was going to go to law school, I would have to basically leave Miami and pay this myself, which is what I ended up doing. And I was 30 years old.
Well, good for you.
Which is, for some people, I did a complete 180 in my life, and I ended up getting accepted. I actually got accepted both to Florida State and University of Florida. I chose University of Florida. Those were the only two schools I applied to. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life, going and getting my law degree. And even then, I thought, well, with an MBA, I'd probably end up doing some type of business work and working, doing either commercial litigation or something along those lines. And in law school, you have the last semester of law school, there is a capstone class called trial practice, where you basically try a case. And you have a partner, and they have a real judge in a real courtroom, and first-year law students are the jurors, and you learn how to try a case. And they assign different cases to each student in the class. And I ended up getting the criminal case. Now, I had never worked with criminal attorneys in my life. And we got the criminal case. So at one point, you work the case as a prosecutor and you present it as a prosecutor. And then you try the case as the defense attorney. Well, we won the same case as prosecution and the defense.
Oh, wow.
And it shows you how important good lawyering is. It was the same set of facts, and you just trying the same case with, against other attorneys. And I ended up booking that class, and it was my first indication of I could do litigation. That was a forte for me. Mm-hmm. And when I ended up in the Tampa Bay area, I ended up getting a job at the Pinellas County State Attorney's Office.
Wow.
Yeah, I never imagined that I'd end up being a prosecutor, and it was the best decision. I enjoyed my years, truly enjoyed my years working as a prosecutor, and my bosses there were fantastic mentors. People don't realize that a lot of attorneys that work in the area, a lot of them actually start at the state attorney's office or prosecuting or even being public defense, mm-hmm. and it's a great way to get experience and try cases when you're young.
What led you to the city council?
Yeah, another interesting story. Somewhere else I never thought that I'd end up. So I was practicing law. My husband and I had going to have a high-risk pregnancy. And I had stopped practicing. So we made the decision that I would stay home. And my daughter was, thankfully, she was born, no issues there, but I was 43 when I had my daughter. So I stayed home, and then after being home for about a year or so, you start getting antsy, and I knew that my husband also, his work schedule required a lot of traveling, he's also an attorney, so it would be very difficult for me to raise our daughter. We didn't have family in the area. And me go back to private practice or even working at a law firm. So I started getting involved in the community, and the easiest way was through the neighborhood association. I remember when I first moved into the neighborhood, we had an active neighborhood association. And I saw the benefits of having an active neighborhood association in our neighborhood, meaning we were engaged with the city. We knew the things that were happening, whether you had the time or not. You got the update through the neighborhood association and can get involved. You also saw the benefits of knowing your neighbors and having that community building that comes with a neighborhood association that's so important, feeling connected to a neighborhood. So our neighborhood association had completely died out. We didn't have any membership. We didn't have a board. So I made it my goal to restart the neighborhood association, and that's how it happened. That is what led to city council, and it was the perfect training ground is the best way that I could describe it for someone whoever would desire to be on city council, because the reality is you are dealing with the same issues that you would deal with as a city council member being in the neighborhood association. So I did everything from beginning it, writing the bylaws, setting up the board to member outreach and getting our neighborhood association involved again. And we had like 25% of the neighborhood that was dues paying, which is amazing that we were able to do that. Mm-hmm. So after I did that, and while I was a president as a neighborhood association.
So can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
Did you do any projects when you were the president?
Did I do any projects? Oh,
yeah,
absolutely.
Like, your neighborhood association did projects? Yes. Can you speak to maybe one of them?
Oh, absolutely. I can talk a little bit about what we did. So as a neighborhood association, it was very important to get different parts of the neighborhood engaged. And you have events, for instance, that are attractive to families, whether it's an Easter egg hunt or Christmas event. But then you have other things like the mentor program, where you have others that may be retired that want to give back to the community in a different way and give their knowledge and experience back. And we were working with neighborhood school to bring in mentors, and we got a room full of people to become mentors in that school and help children. And so we did that. The other big project that I did is getting the neighborhood signs. One of the big parts of a neighborhood association is building that neighborhood identity and that pride in your neighborhood. And you can do it in different ways. And what we ended up doing is getting the neighborhood sign. So I work with the city on getting the matching grant program monies and kind of finding the different ways, because you can do a matching grant with volunteer hours or with cash. And we did it with pretty much, we did some cash, but we did the majority with volunteer hours. So we allowed people to partake in whether it was alley cleanups, the mentoring program at the school, the neighborhood events, those all counted as volunteer hours, late cleanups. So we did a variety of things to engage our community. And then, of course, there were the matters that related to the city in terms of whether it was neighborhood traffic problems, the bike lanes on MLK, and different things that that involved the city itself. I was always making sure that our neighborhood was engaged with the information so we can make the best decision, or at least take the best position for our neighborhood and our neighborhood's interests. So I was a neighborhood president, did not think about city council, and then people start asking you, are you going to run for city council? And now in hindsight, it should be obvious, but that wasn't my goal. And for me...
But I think that's when it works for you, when it's not your goal. Like, right. When it happens organically, like all of a sudden you're like, this is something I enjoy doing, and I could probably make a bigger difference if I did this.
That's exactly right. My husband, because I had a conversation with him, and he saw how much I enjoyed giving back to the community. And my legal background helped a lot. It really did help in terms of maneuvering all the issues in our neighborhood. So it should have been obvious, but to me, it wasn't something I was thinking about. I had been raising my daughter. Okay, I'm getting involved in the neighborhood association. Didn't think anything of it. Next thing you know, hey, what do you think about running for city council? And it wasn't just me at the right time. I think it was me at the right time at the right place. You have to check all those boxes. My daughter was already, I had been neighborhood president, I don't know if it was already 5 years. It was by the time I was done, it's 5 years. That's more than enough. I was on my way out. By the way, if you're ever a neighborhood president, you have to have an exit plan. You have to have someone that takes over, because there's only so much you can do. And even if you want to, I think it's always good to bring in new energy and new ideas in. And it's good for whatever organization, whether it's a neighborhood or any other organization. I think it's important to have a fresh air come in. But next thing I know, my daughter's going to be going to school, and I had those conversations with my husband about, you really aren't doing this. Maybe that's something you should think about. And they reached out to me in terms of, you know, there were consultants that reached out to me in terms of they had seen the work I had done in the city. And by the way, at that point, I had got a neighborhood of the year, a president of the year, all those things, all those awards related to the neighborhood association because of all the initiatives and all the things I'd done. So I thought it was the right step for me at that point in life. And one of the things I really liked, we live in a very partisan world, and we have been, even when I joined city council, was already partisan. One thing that appealed to me about city council, it is supposed to be nonpartisan. It doesn't mean that it always nonpartisan, but it is supposed to be nonpartisan. You're not elected as a Democrat or Republican or NPA. You are elected to represent your city in a nonpartisan fashion. And that was one of the things that appealed to me about it. So, yes, I ran for office and I ended up winning. And I'll go back to the neighborhood association part and my involvement. I didn't just run for office. I was ready at that point. It wasn't like I'm going to throw my hat in, or I did things because I was running. No, I had done all this work, so I was really at that point ready to undertake the challenge of being a city council person, which I think was very helpful.
I knew you at the time, and I have to say that I agree with that. I could see the trajectory happening for you, so it just made perfect sense.
At some point, you build that base, and sometimes when I hear people that are interested and they may want to run for city council from in different parts of the city or whatever it may be, I always tell them, you need to get engaged and start learning your district. Everyone knew me in my district. Like, that was helpful. I understood the issues in my district. And I feel like even as a city council member, now I'm even better prepared because I do have a really good understanding of the dynamics in my district. And that was very helpful. I ran and I've been on city council. I'm as prepared as I was, as knowledgeable as I am in terms of navigating government and understanding my role, because you have to all understand your role. There are people that will come to me and say, can you do this? No, that's not my role. I'm a city council person. That could be the mayor's role. No, that's the Pinellas County Schools. I understood the lay of the land. But even with all that, it's always a challenge when you start a new job and there is a learning curve. And I will say that first year on city council, of course, there's a learning curve. You're working, you're not making the decision by yourself. You're on a panel, on a council with seven other individuals who are also representing their districts. And you have to find a way to work together and make your case. But you want to make your case on whatever issue, but you also have to get others to join in. And that can be very challenging. And then you also work with administration, which is also a different dynamic, by the way, because then you have administration. And one of the things that I think, and I know that this is something you may want to touch upon later in terms of the role of city council, is a lot of times you could have people question, well, isn't this what you do? And it's like, no, that's not my role. That's administration, or that's something that falls within the mayor's purview. And it's not a city council issue. So I can't direct city council, I can't direct employees of the city to do things. The charter prohibits that. We work with them and we have good relationships with them, but there are certain things, there are limitations in my role that it's funny because when you are working in the field or you're an advocate for your neighborhood or you're an advocate on any issue, and I've seen you, Karen, come to city council and advocate on different issues, you're free to do that. There, as a city council member, you'd be surprised. It's now you're just not focusing on one issue, you're representing your district and you're representing the city, because not only does your district elect you, but then you have to run citywide and everyone elects you. So it's just a very different approach when you're on city council on dealing with issues than when you're just advocating in the community for whatever is best for your government or for your organization or for whatever issue you have more things that you have to worry about. And plus you have legal limitations. You can't just do whatever you want. A lot of times you may think something can happen and then you talk to legal and they explain, no, that can't happen because of X, Y, and Z. So the reality is that being on city council, it's much more constrained. I wasn't surprised about it, but in practice, it is interesting going through the process and understanding those constraints and navigating that. I found it really interesting.
So what I find mind-boggling is every time I have been to a city council meeting, I see you all sitting there with these binders. So if you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Lizette Hanowitz, Vice Chair of the City Council. Talk to me about the binders.
Oh, the binders. So let me just point something out. I know Councilmember Montaneri is no longer on city council, but I would always bust his chops about this, that his binders were bigger because he would only print on one side of the paper. So his binders were twice his size.
I think I heard you all mention that once at a city council meeting.
I just thought that was very important to know. So the binders, yes, they are, if anyone is ever interested in running for office, I will say the amount of reading and preparation that is necessary for the meetings, yeah, it's very difficult for people to understand how much they have to read and be prepared. And after a while, by the way, once you start learning, then it's not as tedious. And you'll understand the issues because there is a repetition. The issues repeat themselves yearly. If you go through the budget process or whatever process, you'll find that repetition. But still, you do have to do reading. And you can't just rely on others. We have professionals that are fantastic with the city, obviously. All the departments, they're staffed by professionals, and they present issues to us, but we have a fiduciary duty to do our work. And I take that seriously. And as you saw with the whole historic gas plant deal, I went through all the agreements. That was a ton to give you, just a ton of work. And I didn't just read these agreements. I had to read them and understand them like an attorney so I can have discussions with the attorneys and at those meetings that we have to hash out all these different issues. So it wasn't just, okay, I'm just going to read this like you read any book. It's really critical thinking, and it was very difficult material to go through. And I will tell you, and my husband, this was not my husband's early retirement plan. I always joke about that, even though he's very supportive. But for me to be on city council was not his early retirement plan. But the time that I spent just alone on the historic gas plant, the agreement, reviewing all that, whatever, there's no way the amount of money that I'm paid as city council member would cover that. That was just above and beyond in terms of the work that I would have ever expected to be on city council. To be prepared for a deal that big, which is the largest deal in the city's history, and review the materials and try to be ready, because I did feel the burden.
Well, your legal background,
that's right,
also played a role in that, because you understood it in a way.
Well, you know, I had a responsibility, because yeah, when, you know, the way I felt it, I had that burden on me, because I was hired, you know, I was elected as a city council member, not as the attorney for the city, but sure, you can't forget your role. I am an attorney, right, and that was part of the reason people also elected me, was my knowledge and bringing some expertise. And so you do feel that burden of actually going the extra mile and making sure we're doing the right thing on these agreements and bringing out any of the issues that you may, that I may see. So it was just a lot of work. And I do feel good in the sense of, you know, was I on the losing end of that vote? Sure. But to me, it wasn't whether I was the losing end or the winning end or whatever. To me, the most important thing was you go through the process, you bring out all the issues. I did what I thought was in terms of having those conversations, because I do think the public needs to understand. One thing is to say, are you for or against the deal? That wasn't, the issue isn't whether you're for or against the deal. You really have to understand, what are we agreeing to?
Yeah, what is the deal?
What is the deal?
Yes, I couldn't go anywhere during that time without people saying to me, are you going to get behind this? And then somebody else would say, don't get behind this.
Right.
So it was like you couldn't really gauge the community, because half the people were for it, half the people were not for it. And I don't really think any of us knew enough about it to really make an informed decision. And we had to depend on people that were on the Community Benefits Agreement Committee and the people that were sitting on the city council to make the right decision.
And that's exactly right. Yeah. To be able to make an informed decision, mm-hmm, we were elected because, hey, look, in a democracy, people don't have time to be engaged on everything. They just don't. But they elect representatives who should be engaged and should understand things, so that way they can make the decisions for them on certain things. And so I took that very seriously. And by the way, I went to the neighborhood association meetings in my district, and I would go through the deal and explain to them different facets of it, so they understood what it involved. Because I thought that was extremely important. To me, it wasn't, are you for or against? You have to understand kind of the terms. And by the way, there were people that came and lobbied me, and I would ask them straight up, have you read the term sheet? Because if you're going to lobby me for or against it, I know that people are for and against it, and that's fine. But if we're going to have a sit-down conversation about this, then please tell me you've at least understand the terms of the deal. And then you can attack me. You don't agree with me on this? Okay, we can have a discussion on it, right? Sure. We can have a discussion as to why this is my position on this issue and why you think I'm wrong. And I think that's extremely important. So that was just an example of the work that goes into a city council member. That was a very big deal. Not everything that comes before us, obviously, is at that level. But you have to be ready to take on really big issues in our city, just like hurricanes happen, and how to handle that. And people are relying
on
you.
The Public Services and Infrastructure Committee had the crane collapse.
Right. We had the crane issue. And as you know, you're in downtown. So I'm sure, Karen, you and your neighbors were not happy about that issue.
It was a little scary.
It was extremely scary. And I will tell you, I found out 2 days before it happened.
Right. I think we were all in that same information loop where all of a sudden it's like, what's going to happen?
Right. And and so I usually have a plan when, I've lived in Florida my whole life. Hurricanes happen. I tell this to everybody. Every year you have hurricane season 6 months of the year. I went through Hurricane Andrew. I'm well aware of what a hurricane can do. But I usually have a plan, you know, either plan A, plan B, even plan C. You know, one of those is usually, you always have to have the
get out of town.
Right. Yes. Depending on what the scenario is. I only did that for Irma, but I always have a plan. And my plan for this hurricane was, believe it or not, staying downtown. And
I remember when we spoke about that.
So I mean, what could go wrong? So, right, I'm staying at a hotel where, number one, it's the higher building requirements, obviously ready for the hurricane. It wasn't in an evacuation zone. There was no flood risk. So I felt very confident about where I was at and taking my family there until 48 hours before when I got a call about the crane. And I can only imagine how everyone else in downtown felt.
Oh, let me tell you.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. I got several emails about that. More than several, I would say. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. People were scared.
Yes. Yeah. They should absolutely have been scared and upset about the whole issue. Mm-hmm. And so the worst part was, so I find out about this, and then I find out we can do nothing about it. We're trying to do certain things, but at the end of the day,
yeah,
what you really will want to happen, which is some sort of regulation, we're preempted at the state level, and the state has to do something.
Yeah.
That's frustrating. Well, for those listeners out there who care about this issue, lobby your state representatives to do something about the cranes, because no matter if you're here in the city of St. Petersburg or any other city, if there's a building going up, there's a crane out there. And think about even people, I remember they're building a home and you have concrete blocks that are sitting right in the neighborhood because they're building some home, and then a hurricane's coming and you're worried that those are going to become missiles. A hurricane situation, you have to worry about all these things. So you're worried, you live in a neighborhood, you could be worried about concrete blocks just outside of your home. Imagine a crane.
Yes. I will say this much. I've spoken to two developers who are building downtown within the next, I don't know, year or two, I guess. Both of them, I said, so what kind of crane are you going to use? And both of them said to me, not one that's going to collapse.
I would hope not.
So I think they're thinking about that themselves, whether there's regulation or not. I'd like to hope.
You would hope, and the reality is that if it's not regulated, I mean, there is a cost associated with that risk, and there will be litigation, as there's litigation right now.
Sure.
They were lucky that no one got hurt, but now you still have all the damage that the crane caused and the cost associated with that. So isn't it better to plan accordingly and be safer and reduce the risk by using cranes that could withstand higher wind speed, or locking them down how they're supposed to? I'm not an engineer, but there are certain things that can be done. So yes, the crane issue was an unexpected issue during the storm.
Let's talk about something more pleasant.
Yes.
The Arts Advisory Committee.
Arts Advisory. It's a great group. So I'm on the Arts Advisory Committee, and what is nice about it, so we have different committees that are basically, the majority of committee members are volunteers in the city. These aren't just city council committees, but these are committees that are pretty much driven by community members who care. And in the Arts Advisory Committee, you have a lot of community members who are in the arts, and they care about their community, and they devote their time to giving back on the Arts Advisory Committee. And so what they do is they work on, we have funding that goes to grant organizations. So one of the biggest things that the Arts Advisory Committee does is go through all the applications that we get to make sure that the appropriate organizations that should get the funding. So that's pretty much what the Arts Advisory Committee does. And I always find it, I love going to the meetings because I learn so much from the community itself. You can't be an expert on everything. And that's the hard part about being on city council. All these different issues are brought to you, and there's no way you can know more than the people that do this. And that's how I feel about the arts.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to know much more about the arts community than I will any day. And their expertise is so important for the city, so we can guide those monies to the organizations that need it. So they work really hard to do that, and I'm very lucky that I'm part of that committee.
Well, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed having you here today. I'm so happy you finally...
Is our time coming up?
It's coming close to an end now.
Wow.
I know, but you'll have to
that
come
was
back
quick.
Again. You will have to come back again.
That was quick.
Because I enjoyed so much having you here. And we're right around the corner from City Hall, so we're not that far.
Well, whenever you'd like me to come back, I'd be happy to, Karen. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I've been speaking to Lizette Hanowitz, the vice chair of our city council. She has really enlightened us a lot about a lot of different issues, from the historic gas plant deal with the city to the Arts Advisory Committee and the Public Services and Infrastructure Committee and her journey to the city council. I appreciate you joining me today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.